Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really appreciate you being here to discuss a topic that is in the news each and every day many, many times because there is new information about taxes, tax reform, what's happening these days, especially as more and more people start to file their taxes. Some of them are getting surprises. Over 21% of taxpayers will owe the government, according to the Government Accountability Office. That's 30 million people. Many will be shocked at what they owe. Some of them here in this room, in this building today, not to mention any names or single people out, are paying that they never had to pay before at this time of year. Is that good? Is that bad? We'll discuss it. And, of course, you add in the government shutdown, or the partial government shutdown, as we call it, which created a backlog, we are told, of some 3 million taxpayer questions. Where do we begin? Let's start with the IRS. Luis Garcia is here. We are so happy that he is here from the IRS, spokesman for nearly a dozen different states. He's based here in Michigan. His office is in Detroit. He helps taxpayers avoid scams, get the most out of their tax dollars, and avoid paying too much tax. He has great tips there. Jim O'Reilly, CPA, practice leader at Doran Mayhew, specializing in domestic business, high net worth clients in many industries. He has more than 30 years' experience at the firm. He is on the front line of the tax season, quoted just last week in the Detroit Free Press. He'll tell you what he sees from his vantage point. Maurice Rose, tax attorney, Abraham and Rose. He represents delinquent taxpayers before the IRS. He helps them work deals with the IRS. He's an expert in business, tax planning, compliance, also adjunct professor at the university level here in metropolitan Detroit. And Brad Atkin, CPA, Doran Mayhew, leader in the company's Information Technology Assurance and Security Group. I asked Brad to be here because he trains clients and colleagues in best practices, helping them avoid the bad guys that are out there to get you through your computer or your digital devices. He says that many companies right now are leaving themselves open to possible problems and maybe even lawsuits because of third parties they're dealing with when they're enabling employees to have easy access to tax forms online. We'll get to that in a couple of minutes. But first, Luis, tell us what's going on behind the scenes. We hear all kinds of things that are coming out. What's happening from your vantage point on the other side of the conversation, so to speak?
Well, the good news is a lot of the tax processing for the average person, a lot of our tax processing is automated. So a lot of people who have turned in their tax returns so far, it's a system where, you know, it's no longer the case where you fill out all these forms and, you know, double check it with your pencil and send it in to Kentucky or wherever and have somebody rip that open, take it out, go through it, do the calculations themselves. It's all automated. So for most people, it's gone smoothly. There has been, because of the government shutdown, there has been a bit of a delay in some of the larger tax returns and some of the larger tax processing, but we're all back and we're coming back up to speed.
All right, that's what it looks like from the inside. What does it look like from the outside? What does it look like, so to speak, on Main Street? Jim, tax reform was supposed to be simplification. Is there simplification?
I think for a lot of individuals, there is some simplification. However, the forms are new. So you're looking at them and you're used to seeing page one, where you'd enter all your income and then you'd have some deductions. Page two would be starting with your adjusted gross income and would work its way down to taxable income. There'd be the tax calculation. You'd put your withholding and estimates in, and that would be the end of the return. So you'd have a two-page return. The simplification was meant to make it a postcard that you could just send in. And what you're finding is now that there's still two pages, and it's the size of a postcard, but they've taken most of the return and put it on forms behind. So right now there's...
Is this a sleight of hand here?
It might be a little bit. Well, they need the same...
No offense, Luis.
No, they need the same information. It's just, you know, for a lot of people, they can do one line. If you have wages, that's the line item, one of them on the return. But any other items of income that you have go on these, you know, six schedules that are behind. If you have interest and dividends, there's still a Schedule B that needs to be completed that then goes on to, you know, Statement 2, and then Statement 2 feeds onto the front of the return. And so, you know, there's a little bit more confusion with how the forms are presented. I remember the first 1040 that I got to review, I opened it, and I'm like, oh, boy, you know, here we go. And it was fairly simple. And once you, for us, once we start walking through the forms, it gets easy. But for a lot of taxpayers, they're just doing their return, and it looks very foreign. So, you know, we're seeing, you know, we're getting used to the forms and things like that. And then on the business side, there's a lot of complexities with a lot of changes, and there's still guidance coming from the IRS, and certainly the 35-day, you know, shutdown. I'm sure right now the IRS wish they didn't have to go through that, but, you know, there is a lot of items that are still being talked about, discussed. There's extenders that haven't been put in place yet that typically are, so that delay has hurt a little bit. So, you know, for most people, they can still file timely, but if they're involved in businesses or, you know, have any other activity, there's a little more confusion with it.
And a lot of confusion with people who have to pay and they didn't have to pay before or will have smaller tax refunds than before. Maurice, what are you seeing from your office this tax year, first year of tax reform?
Well, like any change, takes a little bit of planning to stay ahead of the curve. And we tell people two things. Number one, most importantly, don't ignore it if you see a problem or something that's a curveball that you haven't dealt with before. Whether it's a curveball in the form of an audit, whether it's a curveball in the form of a liability, whether it's a curveball that it's just a new form of paperwork, don't ignore the problem. When I speak to new clients coming in, they give a lot of analogies, like we're kind of like going to the dentist. No one wants to deal with this, but it's much easier to go when you still need a cleaning than when you need a root canal. So rule number one is try to get as ahead of the curve as possible. Don't put your head in the sand and avoid it. The second thing is that to keep in mind, we call our practice area, our specialty, tax controversies, whether it's administrative, whether it's collection, whether it's criminal, whether there's a dispute going on. The bigger the level of controversy, whether it's a dollar amount, whether it's a headache, whether it's a dispute that's going on, the more you're best served by seeking a professional rather than dealing with it on your own. Sometimes you might get lucky and you have an IRS person on the other side of the table that aims to help, that wants to help. Sometimes not so, and certainly in all cases, their best interest, their goal isn't necessarily the same as your goal. So two rules of thumb to remember when you're dealing with something unknown is, number one, again, always try to get ahead of the curve as much as possible, and number two, seek out professional assistance so that whatever controversy starts as a cleaning and can be nipped in the bud won't develop till a cavity or losing a tooth.
And Brad, the bad guys are out there. You and I were talking just a little while ago before we began about the phishing issues that are happening that you're seeing this year.
Yes, and what phishing is fake emails, okay? So what we have started to see is about 1 in 300 emails that anyone receives is a phishing email. And a lot of times what that does is that contains something like malware or ransomware, which basically can shut down a system and ask for actual money that you have to pay to someone to actually get your company's system back up in place. The bad news, I guess it's kind of twofold, kind of what's happening, because these phishing emails have increased significantly. And many of you have probably seen it, because over 90% of businesses have recorded that they've received phishing emails or individuals in the past year. But what's happening is 30% of people are actually clicking on these emails, and 12% are actually going through and either filling out a password or clicking on an attachment. So what's happening is we are in tax season. This is the season where a lot of people's private information is held. This is a season where either you're trusting someone else with your private information or someone else is trusting you with their private information. So what we are continuing to see is that there's a need for training. there's a need to continue to understand what phishing emails are, understand what to look for. Understand when you get an email, don't just look at the name who it's from, look at the address, because they're pretending to be someone else. Make sure you look for a common mistake is they have misspellings throughout, because it's coming from overseas. Also look, before you click on any link, make sure you're clicking on, make sure you hover over that link to see what that link even is before you click on it. And obviously be extremely wary of any attachments that you're getting that you don't expect to get.
Just explain, in case everybody doesn't understand, what hovering means.
You can hover over a link with your mouse before you click it, and a lot of times the address that it's going to will show up. A common phishing email that many people have seen is LinkedIn. LinkedIn will send you an email saying, hey, someone's trying to connect. When you click on that email, it says, hey, log in. Go over that little login button. That login button, if it doesn't say LinkedIn.com and it says something that looks kind of like LinkedIn, you know it's taking you to a fake page. Because what people do is they set up a fake LinkedIn page that looks exactly like the login screen. You click on that link in your email, you enter your name and password. Well, now they have some contacts, they have your personal information, and then they can use that to try to glean more information out of you and your company.
Great. Questions, anybody? Yet? Not yet? There will be. Luis, is there any possibility, any talk behind the scenes of extending the filing this year? And the only reason I ask that is because when we were talking up here, when we were listening before about people getting a slower start and that kind of thing, especially with the partial government shutdown?
So far, no. So far, it's Monday, April 15th is the filing deadline. So unless you live in D.C. where you have the Emancipation Day and then it's pushed back to the 17th, but it's still the 15th.
So it's the 15th for everybody, even though for D.C. it's right. Going to be the 17th there. Jim, one of the things that's changing is interest expenses. A lot of people could get hung up on that kind of thing. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, for interest expense, you're talking about claiming an itemized deduction. In the past, if you had home mortgage interest, you would get a deduction for all the interest that you paid on your principal residence, a second residence, and if you had home equity indebtedness, up to $100,000. So all those would be deductible. Under the new rules that are in place, home equity debt is no longer deductible. So if you have a home equity loan, that is no longer deductible home mortgage interest in 2019. And then for very high income or high debt people, there was a limitation on deductibility of mortgage interest. If your mortgage was over $1 million, there was a limit. Now that limit's been lowered to $750,000, and that's true if you had a principal mortgage or a second mortgage. One exception to that is if that home equity indebtedness was used to improve the property. So if you took out a home loan to add on or to redo your kitchen or bathroom or something, they're looking at that as not traditional, as more traditional home equity because you were building equity in the property. That's still deductible. You would have to be able to prove that that's why you took the loan out versus taking it out to take a vacation or buy a car or a jet ski or pay for college or some other what they deem to be personal expense in nature. And then investment interest is still deductible. So if you borrow against your securities and pay your brokerage company to borrow interest, that's still deductible to the extent that you have investment income. So those rules have not changed.
And when people realize that they can't pay, Maurice, what steps should they take, aside from calling you first?
Definitely the first step, because, again, getting ahead of the curve is important. I guess the question to your question is really how much a person owes, because there's a lot of mechanisms out there, depending on the circumstances and depending on the kind of taxes. This is what I mean. We like to think about when a client comes in, we try to think of a more aggressive way possible to see how much of a savings or what kind of options are out there. First, we could discuss an offer in compromise. An offer in compromise is a settlement program that the IRS has that you can approach the IRS to settle for significantly less sometimes than what is owed. You can approach the IRS to settle because the debt fully isn't collectible. There's no way the IRS is going to get this kind of money. You can't get blood from a stone, as they say. You could also try to pursue an offer in compromise if you contest the liability. I shouldn't owe this. So an offer in compromise is probably the biggest potential to save. There's also payment plans. And even within payment plans, sometimes it's a little bit more complicated than just paying off over time. There are streamlined options where if the debt is small enough and you can pay it off over a few years, you probably, that's the easiest line of approach because you get some time and there's very little pushback from the IRS in terms of financial verification or other kind of mechanisms like that because you're paying the debt over time. And there's some provisions to this as well. I don't want to oversimplify. There's also a more traditional payment plan where you are paying based on what you owe at the end of the month, and the IRS will look at your expenses and your income. And there might be some discussions if a person has overtime income or some variability in his income, but generally you're paying based on your ability to pay. A third kind of payment plan could be what's called a PPIA, a part pay installment agreement. Whereas if a tax debt is nearing the end of a statute of limitations, for example, and yes, there is a statute of limitations for tax debts, that you pay an amount for a shorter amount of time until the statute expires. So those are more traditional administrative remedies to approach, an offer, a payment plan. There's also, depending on the kind of taxes, though, for example, and we see this a lot in the case of self-employed individuals, for what's called trust fund liabilities. Now, trust fund doesn't mean you're holding anything in trust, per se, like you might be thinking about, but when you have a business and you're paying employees wages, you have to withhold certain amounts of taxes to pay their self, you know, to pay the income taxes, to pay the Social Security taxes, and the employer matches a portion of that tax as well. Now, those things which, at least in theory, should have been withheld from the employee pay, the withheld income tax and the withheld Social Security tax, that could eventually be personally assessed against what's called the responsible party. Now, what that is exactly, it sounds like a lawyer term, and therein lies the discussion. Is a person a responsible party to individually be liable for taxes that weren't paid over? Now, some of you are thinking, how do you get into this mess? I mean, you're holding with out of the pay, and, you know, and you got to pay what's due at the end of the quarter. But sometimes it's not so simple with small businesses who have cash flow problems, who at the end of the day look at their bank account and say, well, I'm either going to pay this guy his net pay and then keep him as a happy employee, or I might do things more legally proper and remit the taxes that have to be paid, not enough to pay him, because that employee can rely on that withholding to claim his or her own refund. Point being is that if this kind of assessment hits, we are looking at a trust fund assessment against a responsible party who didn't pay over properly, there's a whole other slew of other remedies to contest that assessment or to settle that assessment along the lines that we talked about before, and that could even open the door into litigation, where you could contest that in federal district court by challenging that the assessment should have been made. I guess this kind of gets back to what we were saying before, because any problem usually has a multiple type of avenues for relief. That's one good thing about dealing with a government agency that's as big and powerful as the IRS, and it is probably the most powerful civil law enforcement agency that we've all come in contact with. But usually there are multiple avenues to get things done. And sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not good, but it always means that you should get a professional on board as early in the process as possible.
Yeah. Or just to add one thing on that is you talked about the responsible party. You have to be very careful if you're involved with a business, because you may think that you're not a responsible party, but you may be. So, for example, if you're the payroll clerk doing the weekly payroll and filing the quarterly forms and everything like that, you may be deemed to be a responsible party, even though it's the business owner ultimately that's making the decision not to remit the taxes. And there is personal liability that could be associated with that. So it's not always like the business owner. It could be, a clerk or somebody that just happens to sign the tax return and is sending it in and may even think that the taxes have been paid. So you have to be very careful when you're signing documents that could bring on some personal liability. May not be ultimate out of pocket, but could be a lot of grief and aggravation.
Exactly. Last I checked, and it does go back a number of years, but in the entire Internal Revenue Code, and it's a pretty voluminous code, that particular issue, that section, was the most litigated section in court system across the country. So to be a responsible party, if you're signing checks, as a matter of law, it requires two elements. You have to have authority to make payments, and you have to be responsible to make those payments. And again, we can discuss the scope of that beyond the parameters of this panel, but those are the two things. But as a matter of practice, what happens is usually the revenue officer, the IRS personnel that's charged with that kind of analysis, will just start by looking at the bank signature cards. And anyone whose name is on that bank signature card, even if it's for emergency purposes, will face an assessment. And if you don't do anything, that assessment will become final, and then it'll be moved to collection. But if you got on board with it as soon as you know that that's out there, then usually administratively it can be remedied. But if not, again, there's other remedies as you go through the process as well.
All right. Thank you very much for that clarification. Questions, anybody? Yes. Marshall.
Great points up there. We always tell our clients at Accounting Aid Society, if you get a letter from IRS, open it. It might not be good, but it'll be the best letter you're going to get in the next series of letters. You might want to talk about the child tax credit. That was a real plus this year for people with kids under 17. Thresholds increased, amounts increased.
Okay, for child tax credits, as you mentioned, it's for dependents that are under 17 years of age. And in prior years, the child tax credit was $1,000 per child, and it began to phase out when your income was a little bit over $100,000. Currently, the child tax credit has increased to $2,000 per child, and the threshold starts to phase out at $450,000. So this is one of those, Murray, where there's a big advantage for people that previously got credit. And the reason that the credit increased is because the IRS got rid of personal exemptions. So in a lot of instances, if people had four children, they were getting substantial personal deductions. But maybe didn't get the credit just because of where their income fell. If they, had $200,000 of income, they got the deductions but not the credit. Now there are no personal exemptions anymore. It's gone into all a standard deduction, but the credit's increased to $2,000. Sorry, and the phase out is starts at $450. So a lot more people are getting that and finding that to be very beneficial. Plus, in those instances, if you had high income, you were losing the benefit of your personal exemptions anyways. So this is, kind of a good win for a lot of taxpayers that, we're seeing benefit from that increased credit and increased threshold.
Great. Thank you. We were just talking a moment ago about dealing with the IRS. If you have a problem, you haven't paid, whatever. Maurice was talking about that. But, Luis, there is an appeals process.
There is. And
it's an independent organization, isn't it?
It's independent within the IRS. It's called the Taxpayer Advocate Service. And these guys are, they're former auditors, former revenue agents, and they work within the IRS. It's kind of like an ombudsman office on steroids. And these guys, they will get your case so that if you have a situation that is, you don't understand or you don't think that it's fair, it's always, if you feel more comfortable working with a tax professional, that's fine. Marshall Hunt from the County Aid Society, the volunteer income tax program is fantastic for getting people who don't have a lot of money in connection with the kind of resources and the kind of help they need. So you don't have to be a wealthy person to get good tax help. But the Taxpayer Advocate Service is open for everybody. And if you feel that you're being treated unfairly, if you feel that you are, if you're being not treated like everybody else, and you feel that this isn't fair, you can go to the Taxpayer Advocate Service. If it is causing you an undue financial burden, you're not getting your refund, it's being held up for some reason you don't understand, or that maybe the IRS isn't getting that information to you on a timely basis, the Taxpayer Advocate Service can cut through all the red tape, and they can get that either refund to you on time or stop whatever kind of collection action might be happening. So the Taxpayer Advocate Service is fantastic. They do a lot of great work. They're within the IRS. That's right on the IRS website, irs.gov. Just look for Taxpayer Advocate. and they're there to help. But if you wait too long, and it's the going back to what Marshall was saying, of the first letter you get is probably the best letter you're going to get from the IRS regarding that situation. And just a brief story, one of our revenue agents told me years ago, she was dealing with a mechanic, very good mechanic, not very good bookkeeper, and she showed up at his business and said, hey, you know, we've been trying to get a hold of you, and, you know, we've got a situation here. And the guy said, I don't know what you're talking about. I haven't gotten any letters. And she said, just, you know, just completely shooting from the hip, so to speak, she said, open up that drawer. And he opened up his desk drawer, and out pops all these IRS notices that he's been receiving for almost a year. And they're all unopened. And that's what a lot of people do, is they get something from the IRS and they think, oh no, this isn't good. And they don't even open it. And they don't realize that all they're doing is digging themselves a hole bigger and bigger and bigger, where if you just call and you will work with you. That's the other thing. This thing of the, you know, the IRS, we're going to, if you call us, somebody's going to kick down your door and put handcuffs on you. That's all Hollywood stuff that we don't do. We're here to work with you. We're here to find out the best payment plans possible for you. We're here to make sure that you're a good tax-paying citizen, and that you're able to meet your obligations and not bankrupt you or put you in the poorhouse, but just make sure that you pay what you owe and continue on and make sure that it doesn't happen again.
And sometimes that first letter, it may be a postcard, is an inquiry, and it's actually what some people might think is the initial stages of an audit, but it's an inquiry that asks a question. And if you can answer the question and provide documentation, usually I've seen thank you notes come from the IRS and
sure.
Say, oh, okay, thank you, yeah, fine, goodbye. Right. But if you don't open that and you don't respond and you don't respond and you don't respond.
And actually, that's an audit.
Then you need Marshall.
A lot of people don't understand that most of our audits are through the mail. So if you get a letter from the IRS, you file your taxes, you get a letter, and it says, hey, you said you took this deduction for that, this and that. Can you send us a copy of that receipt? And you send us the receipt. Everything's fine. You don't hear back from us. That was an audit. A lot of people think of the audit as, you know, you're in a dark room with a lamp over your head. There's, you know, guys in black suits walking around and behind you. That's not how it works. So most of our audits is...
Did you ever hear the expression that an audit is like an autopsy without the benefit of death? I've heard that a few times, but okay.
Brad, yeah. Do we have a question? Yeah, I'm sorry. Right here. We'll get the microphone to you there.
Two questions. The first part is the only way the IRS will communicate with you is by written correspondence?
No. We may show up at your door. It's very rare. We may call you. Again, very, very rare. But usually it's the mail. And for certain larger companies and in dealing with certain tax professionals, we do use email. But for the average person, it's... You know, 99.9% of the time it's going to be the mail. But we do call. A lot of times you'll get those, when we were talking about scams, you get those people who are trying to be helpful, but they just confuse things a bit. And they say, the IRS will never call you. No, we will call you. It's rare, but it does happen.
Okay, the second question was then, if you've gotten communication and or you've started a dialogue with the IRS about activities, how can you track yourself back into it? I had an incident where my tax accountant passed away doing our taxes. They could not find the paperwork.
Wow.
So as a result, we went to try and file the next year. They wouldn't allow us to file because the previous year hadn't been filed. So we went into this whole roundabout trying to get it.
Right.
So we've been going back and forth, but it's like I can't talk to anybody or I can't like get...
Right.
I want to go from A to Z, stopping at B, C, D, E, and F, and it's not happening.
Right. I understand. The best advice that I can give you is keep at the process. I wish I could say that, hey, here's a customer service rep that's going to walk you through it step by step. Unfortunately, we don't have the resources for that. But if you keep at the process and work with another tax professional that can kind of, you know, put everything together and amend or file that return and just keep you going in the right direction. But I wish I had a better answer. I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask, what did you mean that they wouldn't let you file? How is it their choice?
So what's happening is that every time we went to file, the company said they won't let us submit it because your previous filing had occurred.
And I'm... So they said we can't go ahead and process. So this happened in, I think, 2009. So 2010, we couldn't put in. So everybody went on the scramble because by then all of our materials had been submitted. Like, they were out of our possession as a organization, as a company. We were at the point we were just about ready to go back to the government and ask them to reissue all of the pieces that were credentials and the pieces that would support the filing, and they happened to find the records. But by then, we were now into almost 2012, and we then immediately went back and filed 2009, 2010, 2011, like all within 6 weeks. And then 2012 came, but the thing that I'm dealing with now is they want me to pay interest off the 2009 because I never paid it. And I'm like, wait a second. I did want to go ahead and handle it. I shouldn't be paying the overage or taxes, the interest. I'm fine paying the taxes. I don't want to pay the interest because the mistake wasn't something I was blatantly trying to do. It was a situation of extraordinary measures is what I call it. And that's how I documented it. And I've got the documentation that goes back and forth, but it's like, well, I send the letters, and then I have to wait 6 weeks, 8 weeks to another letter.
And I can't talk about your individual situation, but just so other folks in the audience know, you don't, you don't have to have 1 year's return filed in order to file the current or a future return. So if you miss a couple years of filing a return, you can file again. And that's sometimes where we have people who they get into they dig themselves a hole because they've missed a year or two of filing for whatever reason. And then they say, well, if I file now, I'm going to get into trouble. And it's not the case. It's usually, if you start filing now, you're going to be able to kind of bring that other stuff back. But if you're not filing, just period, that's a really bad situation to be in. So I would say text. Okay.
I'm still dealing with that. I don't want to throw away the papers because from my perspective, we keep the evidence for minimally 7 years, and I end up keeping it properly. Just for safety purposes. But I've also heard on the other side that if you keep the papers too long, it can negatively impact you. So I'm like, okay, how long do I hold on to this? Because I want to make sure that it gets resolved.
Well, for the average person, it's 3 years is where that tax liability is in place. If it's for businesses, I believe it's also 3 years. If you want to keep it to be safe for, you know, six or more, that's, or as long as you want, that's fine. But if you are, you know, trying to keep down your paperwork or clean out your files, 3 years is where the max that the IRS can, or 36 months is the max that the IRS can go back and say, hey, you owe some money on this, and unless there's a criminal issue.
Yeah, just you have to pick. Criminal issues are open-ended. When there's a larger discrepancy, if the IRS is contesting, I believe, more than 25% of the liabilities, then it could be up to 6 years. And as a practice tip, what we tell clients in such a situation, exactly what he said, is that don't get overwhelmed. Take one step at a time. And usually that involves starting with more current years. Sometimes we see people haven't filed in 6, 10 years, or I don't even remember when the last time was that I filed. And then, okay, let's start with the last year and then work our way back. Because, again, there's certain circumstances where the IRS will only go back a certain amount of time, but take a step, because then what could happen is you could have what I talked about, going to the dentist as an analogy. One situation where some guy, I remember many, many years ago, called me and was talking about he hadn't filed. Again, I'm not sure when it was the last return that I filed. And, okay, we talked about it, and then I got to the question, you know, the fee question. So we talked a little bit about that. He said, I'll have to get back to you, and the professionals in here will know what that means. So okay, didn't think about it. That happens a lot. So then about a month or two goes by, and I get a call from maybe even more than that. Got a call from this guy, and do you remember me? He says, actually, I do, because this was quite an egregious situation. So I said, well, I think I better come in to see you. I was leaving somewhere last week, and two special agents approached me and read me the Miranda. Can I come in tomorrow? So it got him resolved, and everything worked out well. But yes, don't ignore the problem. Don't stick the letters in the drawer. Don't think it'll go away. Just deal with it one step at a time, hopefully with some professional help, and it should be able to be managed the best way possible.
We have a question in the back, but before we get there, very quickly, Brad, we were talking about destroying and getting rid of documents that are more than 6 years old. You don't want to just throw them out. It's got to be very, very carefully destroyed, shredded. Could you just address that and how some of the cyber crooks can get information that you don't destroy properly?
Yes, I mean, I guess that goes on beyond just cybersecurity. I mean, if you have paper records, obviously you would want to shred them, recycle them, things of that nature. Know what you're throwing out. You're not just going to throw it out in your garbage and throw it out to the curb. The same thing can kind of go with some of your backups, getting rid of those, and not having all of that information that can continue to go on beyond those years. Off on some cloud. It's like how we had talked earlier about you're ultimately in charge of the security of your information. If you think that everyone else cares about the security of your personal information, you can get into a lot of trouble. And this goes for your actual records that are in your drawer, but this also goes for where you store your information. There is a big difference between, you know, Jim O'Reilly's cloud service that he runs out of his garage and an Amazon Web Service, okay? There's also a big difference when it comes to tax time if you're saying, okay, I'm going to go use TurboTax. It's kind of trusted. It's kind of known. But I saw this new ad online for I can do my taxes for free with this brand new service where I just put all my information on this website and they file my taxes. It's called due diligence. You need everyone wants your information, so you have to take the right steps to protect your information. You don't want to use the cloud service out of someone's garage. For the same way, if you're going to start using a tax preparer or you're going to start using an actual online tax prep system or you're going to store those files online, you now have a different responsibility for who are they. Let's read up on them. Let's Google them. Let's look at who they are. You can even contact them to say, hey, do you have any package, a due diligence package related to your security?
Great. Okay. Good advice. Yes.
Okay, my question relates to Louise and an audit that I went through several years ago. It actually was a blonde with no gray matter between her ears, but the advocate individual, have they always been there? Or is it something new that the IRS just started with? Because even my CPA did not know anything about this.
Well, the Taxpayer Advocate Service came out of the Reform and Restructuring Act of 1998. So the IRS was completely restructured through the Act of Congress in 1998. And the Taxpayer Advocate Service, which was kind of like a fledgling ombudsman's office, came full strength with a great deal of authority out of that, and they've been up and running since 1999.
This is from an individual tax perspective. Maurice, we've always heard that you should never get a call from the IRS, yet you say there's instances when you might. I mean, you know, when you're dealing with individuals, should we still say don't ever take a call from the IRS? And also, Brad, you talked about phishing and things on the corporate level that are coming in new this year. Should we be looking anything from an individual kind of level that might have changed?
So I'll take the first question. Yes, if you get a call from somebody from the IRS, the biggest difference that you're going to find is, unlike most of the calls that people receive that say they're from the IRS, it's not going to be threatening. It's illegal for an IRS agent to threaten you. If an IRS employee calls you and threatens you, not only are they going to lose their job, but they can face, you know, legal actions against them. It's the three red flags. They're never going to threaten you if you get a call from the IRS. It's never going to be threatening, you know, the police are coming, we're going to deport you, we're going to take your license away, we're going to foreclose on your home, none of that stuff. The other is they're not going to demand immediate payment. When an IRS agent is talking to you, they're going to be talking to you about your trying to get your information updated, or have you received this or that, or talking about a case that's already open. But they're not going to say, you've got to pay this right now, or, and then the threat. And the other is they're not going to say, you've got to pay, but you've got to use a, you know, XYZ credit card, or you've got to use, and just so I can officially put it on the record, the IRS does not collect taxes on iTunes cards. Just making sure. Or Amazon gift cards, or none of that stuff. We collect taxes in, you know, you can pay at 7-Eleven in cash. You can come to our office in cash, a check, a certified check, whatever, wire transfer, credit card online. No iTunes gift cards. So those three things, just be aware that if you do get a call from an IRS agent, there's going to be no threats, no demand for immediate payment, and they're not going to say you have to pay this way. So just keep that in mind.
But I think that's only for phone calls, right? Because I've had many clients who've been visited by revenue officers who weren't so lovey-dovey when they showed up. So a phone call maybe is different, but I think in person, a little bit of a different...
But those may not have been revenue officers. Those may have been special agents.
No, the revenue officers. some of them, and I know we can debate in terms of percentages, but some of them think that they're out there doing God's work, and that's a problem sometimes. But that's a discussion for a different day.
And yes, what I see personally outside of the business, because let's say personally our assets aren't as valuable as them specifically targeting, but it's easy. The IRS emails, initiating, and get me if I'm wrong, your IRS isn't going to initiate that audit.
Correct.
Through a first-time email. But some people think they do.
Or social media.
Yeah,
we're not going to direct message you on Instagram.
Yeah. They're not going to comment on your photos. So what's happening is you're getting IRS, but what's also with that is obviously the phone calls, and they go kind of hand in hand, because anytime you're receiving a phone call and someone's asking you to pay money, my first response is always, I'll call you back, because then I'll go on the website and call the number, just be like, hey, if I call this mortgage company, can I ask for you, kind of thing. The same thing's kind of happening. People think that, oh, I'm not going to pay off an email. But there's also other things you can do off an email. And I see significant increases even personally on phishing, because they can get your logins. And with your logins, they can try to get into different accounts. If they say... sign into your Gmail, they might try that password at a bank. So they are definitely increasing. A lot of those stats are kind of worldwide. A lot of the studies are on businesses. Some of them reach out to individuals as well. It's increasing because it's so easy. You download a list of email addresses. They can throw in malware or spyware or, you know, ransomware or anything they want to throw in there, and it's easy pickings, because when people aren't at work, they're just clicking away on their home computers. So I see a significant increase in that, but most of that is related to sign in here or you owe this money. If you ever click on an email and it takes you to a page to put in your credit card number, just stop. Just stop. Re-go to that web page and log in. You know, I got a call the other day, actually related to Apple, from my mother-in-law. She's like, I got an email, and it says, I spent all this money on iTunes, and I owe them money. I overspent whatever was in my account. So I click on it, and it wants me to log in. I can't remember my password. And I said, well, good, because you didn't do that. And you know what? Don't click on the email. Go to Apple, log in, and if there's a bill there, then maybe it's legit. Does that answer your question at all? Okay. Yeah.
Actually, I have a fraud call on here that I'm trying to get, and hopefully we'll be able to hear it, but perhaps not. But it's a call that came in.
24 working hours. Then once it gets expired after that, you will be taken under custody by the local police, as there are 4 serious allegations pressed on your name at this time.
The fact that I'm still here indicates that that was not true, because that came some months ago. And I just recorded it because we like to use those things on the radio sometimes to do what we did here, which was vividly tell you what's going on. Okay, a couple more questions. One right here. Yes.
We have a small business. Over the last 5 years, we went from writing paper invoices to now using QuickBooks. And we doubled our staff, doubled our revenues over those last 5 years, too. At what point do we look to maybe separate our accountant, our CPA, from our taxes? Is there a certain threshold or what have you in terms of trying to separate the two and let them be individuals and for to make sure that, you know, everything's, in other words, we have some form of check and balances who for the people that's overlooking our books?
I don't completely understand the question because really, the size of a business may not dictate, you know, the need for a CPA or not having a CPA. There are, you know, some businesses that are sizable that have their, you know, their own tax department, and I don't know if the question is whether or not, you know, you try to do it yourself or you try to bring in a professional.
No, here the reason why is because over that 5-year period, through our growth, we haven't seen, I guess, the same terms of understanding or service from the organization, too. And it's a small CPA firm, you know, maybe have one or two tax preparers or accountants and things of that nature, a couple of office staff. But the reality is, as we're growing, we're starting to see that we don't have the support services. So is there a certain point where we should just go ahead and let the accountant be the accountant and then bring in maybe a tax preparer? And then at the same time, they kind of oversee and have a check and balance to make sure one is doing right or the other is doing right and support our organization.
I think that point in time is immediately when you have those reservations that you don't think you're getting the proper advice or that they're not giving you the advice that you think you need. At that point in time, you know, you either need to, you know, find somebody with some more experience as you're growing, or, you know, if it's a double check because you feel comfortable with them doing the bookkeeping task but not necessarily the tax task, then there are, you know, people out there that would come in and just do, you know, or can assist with the tax side of it. So I think that you kind of answer your own question. As soon as you feel something's not right, it probably isn't, and that's probably when you need to, excuse me, seek some additional assistance.
Question over here. We have a couple. Yep, right behind you, sir, and then we'll be right at you.
Good morning. For Luis, if an individual was making the payments, monthly payments for the payment arrangement, and they missed that one on the because the government shut down, because they used to do it in the IRS office, is there going to be any solution for them?
You want to make sure that within that period you're fine. I mean, as long as that payment is made and you continue on with your regular payments, you should be fine. There's no issue, especially because there's government shutdown. But I would recommend, instead of going in person to set up an online automatic payment or something that'll make it more convenient for whoever, for those of you that are looking at payment plans, there's a certain security that you get when you physically go into the IRS office and hand the check or the cash or whatever to somebody. But once you get over that kind of initial, fear of like, are they going to get it or not? I think you'll find that doing it online is going to be so much more efficient and less time consuming. And you're going to get it because you could have done it online. IRS continued to accept payments online during the shutdown. So just consider that as an option.
Oh, yes. That was one of my clients, new clients. And then I showed him how to do it online. But he do it late for a couple of times. There's going to be, you said that is no penalty, no nothing for that?
Not during the shutdown. Well, it depends if it's more than once, and if it depends on how late it was, that they may be then voiding the payment agreement. So if you're on a payment agreement with the IRS, mm-hmm. make sure you make those payments because it's, like I said, a lot of our stuff is automated. And if you don't stick to what you agree, it's human nature to say, I've made this agreement, but, something really bad happened and I couldn't make it. And you don't understand that most of your communication with the IRS, much of it is automated. And if you simply don't make that payment, for whatever the reason is, that voids that payment plan. So just keep that in mind.
Just to follow with what he's saying, it's important to note that if, for whatever reason, something does get kicked out of the system because of a mispayment, it's a relatively straightforward appeal. They're not going to send you off to oblivion someplace. When they want it, they'll give you a notice that they want to default that agreement and that will give you certain appeal rights, a collection appeal program, a CAP, C-A-P, and it's a simple one-page form, 9423, and it's a quick appeal, and they should be able to get you back in if there was a glitch someplace.
Thank you. Question right here, sir.
Yeah, back to the phone calls from the IRS. I have no experience, but you talk about the internet phishing for information. When the IRS calls and they say, well, we want to verify, is this a possibility? We want to verify your Social Security number, and you give it to them. How do we know who's on the other end of that phone?
If you ever have an issue if you receive a phone call, and if you have an issue that you're not dealing with the actual IRS, ask for their number and hang up, and then call the 800 number, and also ask for their badge number. We all have badge numbers. Hang up and then call that or 800 number, which is admittedly not the most pleasant thing to go through, to wait till you finally get to somebody. However, when you do, you can verify whether that person is in fact an IRS agent or not. And to get back to those scam phone calls, the thing that you have to understand is what these crooks are doing is completely terrorizing you, freaking you out so that your higher mental ability is turned off and your kind of reptilian reactionary brain kicks in and is like, I got to get this off me. I got to stop the police coming. I got to stop my home from going into foreclosure. And what they do is they panic you so that you don't think, oh, I need to confirm or I should talk to my accountant or I should call the 800 number that's on the IRS website. By panicking you, what they're doing is, and it works with everybody. When the scam really first started to kick off, there were a lot of people saying, laughing at people who were scammed, saying, oh, they're so unsophisticated. Well, it happened to a good friend of mine who has multiple PhDs, is a college professor, is super sophisticated, is a true intellectual. And he got the call, and he freaked out, and he came over to my house. The look on his face, honest to goodness, I thought that one of his kids had died. I mean, that's the only thing that I could think of. And then he said, I got a call from you guys. And it was a Saturday. And I was like, you did? And then he started telling me the call. And I said, we've been talking about this for months. I told you it's a scam. He's like, no. I have the guy on the line. And he gives me the phone. And I start talking to the guy, and the guy said, look, if you don't hand the phone back to this guy, we're going to send the police right now. And so I try to have some fun with it, But I realized I was just terrorizing my friend even more because he thought I was antagonizing, you know, my fellow IRS agents. But it's the thing is, these calls, when they come in, you don't expect them. They're very scary. And their goal is to get you to shut down your thinking and shut down what Brad is saying. Go to the website or go to something other than what they're telling you over the phone to get independent confirmation that you're dealing with who you think you're supposed to be dealing with. And otherwise, just hang up.
Very quickly, Brad, would you just explain for people who work in small businesses or who run and operate small businesses here about SOC, SOC, and what that is, what that report is, and why they may want to check that out if they're using any kind of third party when it comes to the Internet out there?
Yes, and what SOC is, SOC, is System and Organizational Controls. So what that is an independent auditor went out and audited the controls of who you're using. Many of us have heard the stories. Like last year, there was a casino that was hacked through the thermostat in the fish tank. Someone was able to hack into that because it was connected to the Internet, get into the system, and get everyone's things. We've heard about Target, where Target wasn't breached, but their third-party vendor was breached. And because of that, they were able to get into Target and get everyone's credit card information. What a SOC audit is, and there's two types. You can use it over someone that's processing data for financial information, but a SOC 2 relates to things like security and availability and processing integrity and confidentiality, things of that nature, where you can actually request that, and it shows that an auditor came in and audited that. If you're putting a significant amount of private information as a business to another company, it's your responsibility to do that due diligence. They may not have a SOC report. You may not have enough firepower of what you pay them to say you have to get a SOC audit. But many of those things, like if you want to use, how I mentioned earlier, Amazon Cloud Service, you know, as a company, you can request their SOC report so that you know the controls they have in place and someone has verified them. If they don't have it, there's still things you can do. Find a due diligence questionnaire online of things that you can ask them if you don't know what to ask. Have someone in IT speak with them. Know that they've put some protections in place because it's you. Like I said, it's your responsibility. If you hold any data, both personally and as a company, to either request a SOC report or request some sort of vendor due diligence, so that you know that you've done what you can do, and then you can actually make smart business decisions and also smart personal decisions related to where to keep that information.
Two questions. We have one first here and one.
How frequently would you suggest we go after this SOC report?
Now, a lot of auditors will request them, obviously, yearly. If it's, let's say you're using an ERP system, well, if they're doing your accounting or you have a cloud-based accounting system, that would be every year that whoever's auditing you would need to see that if you're getting an audit. But typically this is every year because the people that are doing them want to cover substantial portions of your year. A SOC audit is controls over a period of time. So they'll have different year ends. So there might be, you know, October 1st to September 30th. It might be a calendar year end. But they cover controls over that period of time that you're good. Now, when you're doing your vendor due diligence, depending on your organization, it depends how significant the private information are. You know, I mean, if you're a financial institution, you're going to be getting it every year, especially if you're doing it depends what you put there. But if you're putting some information out there, I would suggest once a year you ask for that SOC report. But some people do it every other year, and then they can provide you a gap letter, which is a letter from them saying, well, in between when the auditor came out and now, nothing significant has changed. And so you might find that you're comfortable getting a SOC every other year. Now these are slowly starting to completely come up the curve. I'm getting requests twice a week now because they've really taken off because people see what happened. Like Target's a really big example. So, you know, you're seeing the automotive industry. You're starting to see it in the healthcare industry. You're seeing where those auditors of big companies, if you're getting any of their data, will request you to have a SOC audit. So you're starting to see that popularity rise.
All right, as we wrap this up and as we drive back to the office or to wherever we're going, what should we be thinking about and taking away from the conversation? Luis, start there.
File early.
It's too late. We can't do it now.
Well, what you want to do is make sure that if you need a tax professional, make sure you do your due diligence. You know, this is the one time of year where you're giving all of your personal information. You're giving your children's social security numbers, your social security numbers. Everybody in your family is exposed, and there are some people who will take that information and they will see a handwritten sign at the grocery store, and they'll take the number and give their taxes to that person because they guarantee them a big return. Make sure that you do your due diligence when you work with a tax professional, that they have a secure system so that they're not, because the scammers are now really targeting tax professionals for your information. If you go with a software company, make sure that it's vetted and legitimate and an actual software company that's going to do your taxes and get you the best refund or tax situation that you can, as opposed to something that's just there to get all your personal information. And if you do it yourself, remember, there's free file. You can do your taxes online for free at irs.gov. And if you're low income, our friends at Accounting Aid Society through the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, lots of great people volunteer. They'll do it for free. And file it electronically and securely.
And they do a great job every year. Thank you, Marshall, and all your people. Jim.
I think the best advice I would give is to be careful and make sure that you read and try and understand what you're doing. And perhaps when if you've gone through and done your return, there are, areas, the IRS has an area where you can kind of plug in your information just to verify that the tax you're computing is coming up correctly. Or, there are, if you go out there and look at, tax calculators, to at least maybe do a double check, especially if you're doing it yourself. And to make sure that you're looking at all the different deductions that you're eligible for or credits that you're eligible for. And if you're looking at certain credits that are being computed, but they're putting warning signs out. So, for example, residential energy credits, if you put new insulation in, that's a credit that most likely will be extended, but it hasn't been yet. So I have a return right now where that happened. The form's there and everything, but Congress just hasn't passed that extender bill, so we're waiting on a $500 credit for insulation that he put in. Whether they'll extend that specific one or not, we don't know. But last Friday there was a push finally in Congress to get the extenders passed because people need to file their returns. So there's items like that you just need to be careful to make sure that you're, get filing early, but you don't want to file too early before maybe something that benefits you will be available or eligible that you'll be eligible for. So just be careful as you're going through and make sure you're reading everything and taking care of yourself first and foremost.
Very quickly, if Congress doesn't act on that by April the 15th, you can't take it, obviously. But then what happens if they do act next month, the month after that, and they say, yeah, it's okay?
If there's a subsequent update and you've already filed your tax return and your circumstances change or you're eligible for something that's further, you'll have to go back and file an amended tax return and claim that. You see them pass these extenders. I think the 35-day delay has put them a little behind, but I think you'll see a lot of this come up before the end of, before the end of the month or very beginning of March. So there should be enough time before February 15th, April 15th, hopefully. But, one example, Murray, sorry to go, there's on Monday, the 25th, they're talking public hearing about the new interest deductions for corporations. So that's February 25th. They're going to have to digest all the information they get and come out with a change.
See,
corporations
should,
have to file should, March 15th.
I think they should just say, forget April 15th. Let's make it July.
No, thank you.
He wants to take the family on vacation.
Enjoy the summer.
Maurice.
I guess once you get over the amazement and bewilderment of realizing you spent an hour listening to riveting tax conversation, my takeaway would be that when you have an IRS situation that's a problem, a controversy, or a headache, that it's not going to go away on its own, and that it's going to evolve to something else. Now, whether that something else is just a slightly bigger headache, a tremendously bigger headache, or something criminal, it's something that should not be ignored from the outset. So don't stick the envelopes in the drawers. Don't think that the easiest way out is just to kind of ignore it, even to take an easy way out and write a simple letter. If it's something that's giving you, piggybacking on what you were saying before about when it was time to upgrade your controller or your CFO, same thing. If it's something that's giving you angst, it's probably worthwhile to speak to a tax professional that can help navigate through the system before it does become something too big.
Brad, before we get to your final word, there is one more question in the back. Yes.
Yes, hi. You were talking about deductibles. In regards to the charitable deductibles that individuals can take, it's been a big change. We can't take them because the limits are so high now. Can that be carried over? In other words, if I did it this year and didn't have enough, can I carry it over to the next fiscal year?
Unfortunately, no. If you can't deduct it in the current year, Marie and I talked about this, about a year ago maybe, and we talked about the concept of bunching charitable contributions. So if over the course of 2 years you make enough charitable contributions that you'd be able to deduct them, you may consider not making any charitable contributions in 1 year and then doubling them up in the next year. And for, you know, most, you know, a lot of organizations understand this concept, and will, you know, they're gladly take your money even if you're only giving it every other year. But that's the only way, because the deduction for charitable contribution is based on the year that it's made. And unfortunately, you can't take contributions that you made in 2018 and try and claim them in 19.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Brad, final word.
My final word would be kind of twofold. One, for individuals. Know your information, how to protect it, like I said. Look for signs of phishing emails and for vishing, which is like phone calls. Look for signs of phone calls. Look for signs of emails. Continue to make sure you protect your information. And then the other one would be for organizations and also tax preparers. There's a responsibility here to protect this data. 50% of attacks last year were on small and medium-sized businesses, which is beyond what people think. People think they only go for the big fish. They're going for everyone. So understand what it takes. Understand that the organization and your firm needs the proper firewalls. They need the proper backup systems. You need to get a vulnerability assessment to make sure that you don't have a ton of open holes that are neon signs for hackers to come in and take that information. Have someone do a risk assessment or kind of go through a high standard to see kind of where you match up against something like NIST or ISO, just so you can understand where those holes are. And sometimes it's just introductory. Change some password policies. Change some update settings to make sure you're actually running patches that have big security implications on time. Those types of items, you can take sometimes simple steps to reduce risks pretty significantly. We'll never be able to 100% reduce those risks because hackers evolve as fast as anybody can catch up. But you can take some significant steps. So look into those steps if you have any information of whether it be clients or whether your company has personal information.
I know we're running a little over, but I just want to ask you, I have to ask you just very briefly, tell me about the company here in Metro Detroit that had to close down for 2 weeks because one of the employees hit a phishing link on an email.
Yes. these malwares are just evolving. There was a company that I had talked to that an employee just clicked on a link in an email. Now, there was no formal like incident response policy. There's no formal policy that people have talked about as to what to do when you find it. So what happened is someone got some email for a gift card, click on a link. All of a sudden, the server starts running slow. All of a sudden, the server starts shutting down randomly. All of a sudden, there's all this thing. So they look at it, and it was the Emotep virus. So they get this virus in that not only infects every single computer and every single registry and every computer that's online, but since they didn't respond, for 2 weeks they let it just infect every single machine that's connected to the internet. And then that virus connected to the internet itself, and since no one's monitoring internet traffic, it starts downloading more viruses from China onto this company's machine, onto every single machine. But you know what you have to do when something like that happens? You have to shut down every single computer that's connected in this company. And they had like 7 locations. So 7 locations, computers have to be shut down, and you have to turn one on at a time. Because if you turn 2 on, by the time you clean one, the other one will just infect it. So they had to shut down operations 2 weeks. And then slowly go computer to computer to computer in order to slowly get rid of this virus. That is a $1 million problem when your company shuts down and you can't ship. That is no longer a $10,000 problem. And so the proper training, the proper policies, the proper incident response of, hey, I clicked on a link. Okay, shut down that computer. Disconnect that computer because we know it's there. If they disconnected that computer when that person clicked on a link, it wouldn't have infected 7 locations and hundreds of computers.
Brad, thank you so much.
Yeah,
Maurice,
no problem.
Thank you. Jim, Luis, thank you very much. Thank you all for being here. And a special thanks to Lawrence Technological University for once again hosting us. Hope you'll take information away that's helpful for you and for those who you do business with. I just want to tell you we will meet here again for the next Leaders and Innovators on March the 28th. It's a Thursday. The topic will be what's happening today in the automobile industry that will impact every single one of us in this room. We're talking about people who sell in the auto industry, who work in the auto industry, who use the auto industry. What about the companies in the auto industry? They have a problem right now. They are spending billions of dollars on the future to get that new technology up and the mobility up. At the same time, they have to survive today and keep their current business operating. And we know that the business is slowing, and we know that prices for them are going up. So where do we as individuals in this community fit in? That's where we begin the discussion on March the 28th. Spread the word. Hope you can all be here. And thank you again for being here today. Take care and have a good day. Thank you.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? We make getting custom window treatments a minor project with major impact. Choose from premium blinds, shades, and shutters. We even have options for your patio, too. Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Our design experts can help you find the perfect window treatments on your schedule. We'll even send free samples directly to you. Plus, we can handle the measuring and installation for you. Unlimited window treatments installed for just one low cost. And with Blinds.com, you'll always get transparent pricing. No hidden fees. Our free shipping and 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step. And into your home, too. Shop Blinds.com right now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off for a limited time at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.